If you haven't been to the domes in a while, now might be the time to start planning your trip. The Horticultural Center was named one of America's 11 most endangered historic places. We'll have more on that later in today's Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for listening. In our first segment, we'll hear from reporters Dave Amhafer and Sarah Hauer. Dave and Sarah have been investigating the after effects of Act 10. The legislation, which limits the collective bargaining power of public employees, is now 5 years old. Dave and Sarah joined editor Greg Borowski on this week's JS on Politics show to discuss their findings.
We're joined now by two of our reporters, Dave Amhafer and Sarah Hauer, to talk about a special project and report coming in Sunday's Journal Sentinel. Dave, you spent a lot of time on this, as did Sarah. Looks at Act 10 5 years later, so everyone remembers the uproar of that time in 2011, but there's been a lot of upheaval since then. So talk a little bit about what you found in terms of what's happening in the classrooms here in Wisconsin.
Sure. There's been a real change in the balance of power in classrooms, in school operations. Teachers lost collective bargaining. They lost their collective voice, and management is firmly in charge. There's been major changes in the way teachers are hired and fired and paid, evaluated, assigned. They've really lost a lot of the influence they had over these kind of internal things, and changes in the way that pay is linked to performance, and merit pay is becoming more in vogue in schools, which is something that not only teachers have fought, but many superintendents have fought as well.
Right. So Act 10, of course, really undid a lot of the collective bargaining, you know, rights and positions for the unions, and gave a greater hand to management. But let's talk a little bit about how you guys went about evaluating this. So, Sarah, tell us a little bit about what you did to get to the bottom of what's really happening out there.
Yeah, one of the toughest parts in doing this project was that there's not one solid resource out there, really, with the information that we wanted to be able to say what's happened in schools. So we ended up administering a survey to all the superintendents in the state of Wisconsin, asking about finances, asking about teacher quality, and many, many factors, and ended up getting about half the superintendents to respond to us, and so we could use that to really cut through some of the political rhetoric.
Yeah, we should mention this project was done with the great assistance of the O'Brien Fellowship Program at Marquette University, where Dave spent the academic year and Sarah assisted him there. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the particulars. So one thing you discovered as you parsed through all this was that there's signs that districts, sort of the haves and the have-nots, may be faring differently in terms of attracting teachers, retaining teachers. What can you summarize that a
little
bit?
Sure. A little bit of background. Teachers used to have great protections on pay and on job security that were linked to how long they taught in a certain school district. Those protections are gone, so they're really free to move around now, and teachers increasingly are moving from one school district to another. This has led to a real kind of free agent, free market competition among districts with different financial strengths and weaknesses, different financial histories, more or less ability to approve a referendum. So you really have a new era where money really matters now in keeping your best teachers. And there's kind of a free-for-all out there going on, and it's a whole new world for superintendents. And there's a lot of talk now about districts being divided into this kind of have and have-not grouping.
Yeah. So what, Sarah, what surprised you the most in terms of the results you found, or was the most sort of striking or interesting thing to you about the project?
Mm-hmm. So some of the discrepancies that we saw in terms of these haves and have-nots was really interesting. Another thing that was fascinating to me was the difference in views on Act 10 between young teachers and old teachers, and how older teachers who had really experienced that tumultuous time when Act 10 went into effect had much different views on it than young teachers who came into the profession once it was already in place and that was already the lay of the land.
All right. We should note one thing that we couldn't answer, and it really isn't answerable, and I'll ask you, Dave, to explain that in a moment, is the performance and what's happened in the classroom. There's all sorts of reasons why we can't look back and say, well, here's what are students doing better or worse, but why is that?
I mean, the education world is swimming in data, test scores, but there's been so many changes in recent years to what tests the students are taking, a lot of political fights behind that, that it's really difficult in the short term at least to see and track how districts have done over time. It's just really difficult, and a lot of the effects of Act 10 probably are long term anyways, so there's not a, like a black and white answer as to, you know, is a district doing better or worse, and how has Act 10 fared?
And some of that is related to the test changes, and you don't have a baseline from before Act 10 because of that and so forth. Mm-hmm. So this was a very interesting project. You can find it on Sunday in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and then again next Wednesday in the Journal Sentinel, but also at jsonline.com. So we hope you'll pick it up and take a look.
To find out more on this investigation, pick up today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You'll find additional information at jsonline.com as well. Journal Sentinel business reporter Joe Tashler is giving readers a behind-the-scenes look at the rapid growth of Davian's, a food and beverage company based in Menominee Falls. The growth is because of the company's micro-markets, small mini-marts that offer food like what you would find in a bistro or deli, only instead, it's in your company's break room or cafeteria. In this segment of Behind the Headlines, Journal Sentinel reporter Ashley Lucerne interviews Joe about his upcoming story and learns what he found to be the tastiest micro-market offering.
So, Joe, you have a story coming up this weekend in the business section, and it's about Davian's. What is that?
They're a locally owned food and beverage company based in Menominee Falls. They've been around for a few decades, and they do catering and that sort of thing, but they also have a vending and food service business where they actually go and service company break rooms, lunch rooms, that sort of thing.
So when you're describing that, what does that look like? I know we have vending machines here in the Journal Sentinel. You put in money or a credit card, you might get a bottle of soda or a bag of chips. But this sounds like something much different.
This is a trend that's really sweeping the nation right now. In 5 years, it's gone from under 1,000 of these, what they call micro markets. They're essentially little stores within a company break room or a cafeteria. And it's gone from under 900, about 950 5 years ago, to they think by the end of this year, there will be 17,000 of these facilities in place. And again, what they are, it's like a small deli or mini bistro that it's self-service, so you can get, you know, fresh food, salads, sandwiches, breakfast entrees, dinner entrees, just whatever. It's very customizable, and it replaces some of the food that you can get in a vending machine. Not that there's anything wrong with vending machines, but what this does is it addresses a trend where Americans want healthier choices in all of their food, whether it's at home, work, restaurants. This is, happens to be work.
So you mentioned the rapid rise of these mini markets. You also mentioned that it's part of a larger trend of people wanting healthier food. What else explains the growth?
Well, a big part of this is a tight labor market across the U.S. You know, I think we're standing in an unemployment rate at, what, 4.5%, 5%? I'd have to double-check the numbers. But it's the labor markets in the U.S. are increasingly tightening. It is becoming more difficult to find and and then retain good people. So this is also seen as an employee perk. So you could take a prospective employee through your company and say, look what's available for lunch or dinner, or depending, again, on the shift. But we have this entire market here, and you can kind of customize it and order whatever you want. This is a lot better than the 40 or 50 items that you could get in a vending machine at our competitors.
And what are some of the most popular items they're selling from these mini markets? Are there salads or soups, or do they have any idea?
Well, it all depends. It varies on the various workplaces. You know, some places might like the grilled chicken Alfredo, but I also know there's other people who are selling, whole bean Starbucks in their mini markets. So you could, if you can put a barcode on it, you could sell it in one of these facilities.
So did you get to try any food?
Well, I tried a couple things, and it was actually pretty good, but I more relied on people who actually have these in their workplaces, and I just asked them. I said, hey, how's the food? They said, it's terrific. It's really good. They make it fresh every day in their commissary. They, 3 o'clock in the morning, they're in there whipping up lunch for the day.
So, but of the things you sampled, what was the best?
It's hard to say. It was, what did they have? They had grilled chicken and Swiss. They had turkey sandwiches on pretzel buns. It was okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Joe.
Sure. Thanks, Ashley.
Read Joe's story in the Journal Sentinel this weekend and at jfonline.com. As I mentioned earlier, the Mitchell Park Horticultural Conservatory, also known as the Domes, gained a national distinction this week. Truth be told, I don't think it's one people were hoping for. Here's Sarah Howard once again with the details on this story. So, you wrote a story about the Domes this week, specifically a new designation that it was given, although not necessarily a good designation. Tell me a little bit about it.
So, just this week, the National Trust for Historic Places named the Domes onto its list of the 11 most endangered places in the United States.
So what does that mean for the future of the Domes?
So the designation is for sites that are either endangered of being torn down or risk, unrepairable damage. And so what the designation does is really just calls attention to the issue. It doesn't necessarily offer any insurance that these sites will stay in our place. But over the nearly 30 years this list has been put out, only 5% of the sites that have been named to it have actually been lost. So there's a pretty good success rate of gathering people and rallying them around these places. There is a petition on the Saving Places website for people to voice their support of keeping the Domes alive in Wisconsin. So maybe that'll have an impact, especially if Chris Abley sees there's community support for them.
Okay. So mainly this designation is a big thing to just try to raise awareness of it, which could be good if you're in favor of keeping the Domes, because the issue has kind of fallen to the wayside since the repairs were done on one of them.
Yeah, since the tropical and show domes have reopened, I think people have kind of forgotten about the problems that exist at the domes. And part of that is because not as many people go to the domes as need to for successful operations.
So what other buildings were given this designation?
So in Wisconsin, the domes are the third site to be given this designation. Just a few years ago, the Milwaukee Soldiers Home was given this designation, and just in August, a proposal was approved to save a few of the sites and really repair them to working order. So that's a great success.
So what makes the domes special then?
So the domes were built about 50 years ago, replacing an old conservatory that had been built 50 years before that. So having a conservatory in this space dates back to 1898. So it's a historic and it's been a fixture of the Milwaukee landscape for a really long time, which I think is partially why people are so attached to them. So they were designed by Donald Gribb back in the day, and it's a great, great representation of mid-century modern architecture. They're actually the first cone-shaped domes to be built, which is pretty cool to have them here in Wisconsin. And even the First Lady at the time, Lady Bird Johnson, she came out for their dedication. So everyone across the country was pretty excited about them. And they're actually framed with concrete, which we definitely probably wouldn't do today. And then they have the steel and glass over that concrete frame that gives them that beehive-type structure.
I wonder, so what are some of the downsides or complicating factors in maintaining the domes?
A lot of them is that since they were inventive at the time, the methods and practices that they used hadn't been really vetted and tested out as well. So unlike if we were going to build them again today, we'd probably make some different choices in terms of how the pieces come together to avoid issues with water and leaks and cracks and all the stuff that visitors probably don't want to experience.
You'll find Sarah's story at tapmilwaukee.com. That does it for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell, signing off. Take care until next week.